Hi, I'm Rob Spall.
And I'm Britt Garner.
Welcome to Nature Insight.
Speed dating with the future. Welcome to the IPBIS podcast, where you get the chance to put biodiversity, science, and policy under the microscope as we bring critical issues about nature and people out of the lab and into your living room.
In our last episode, we heard about an incredible expedition to the Antarctic, which provided insights not only into that extraordinary environment, but also into the many values of nature beyond use, as well as the importance of overcoming barriers to accessing nature.
Oh, absolutely. And as we heard, that expedition was so successful and valuable in so many different ways, not least of which it helped us all to consider the vital role of the Antarctic and to think about the impacts that landscapes have on us and also that we have on landscapes. But we are now moving, metaphorically speaking, away from the kilometers of ice and snow over to the centimeters of news report columns and stories. In this episode of Nature Insight, we're turning the tables, or at least the microphones, on the media, looking into the importance of journalism in explaining, raising awareness, and amplifying our understanding of the global biodiversity crisis.
Environmental issues have increasingly made the headlines, but biodiversity has often been relegated to minor mentions or sometimes neglected entirely, especially by comparison to climate change stories. The recent wildfires over the summer in southern Europe and North Africa are a good example. The tragic consequences for human life, for health and for property, received a lot of international coverage. It was cast often as a vivid example of some of the impacts of climate change. But the links to biodiversity loss, both in terms of the intensified risks and how ecosystems themselves were damaged and degraded by those fires, got much less media attention.
Part of me thinks, you know, okay, that checks out. Like, isn't that the way we would expect the media to cover that story?
To some degree, yes, Britt, but I think we both know journalists have really a lot of influence in shaping the way that people see issues through their stories.
Sure.
It's easy to say coverage should change, I suppose, but the media also have priorities about what they cover and why. So to get the perspective of one of the leading environmental journalists, I spoke to Patrick Greenfield, who is the biodiversity and environment reporter for both The Guardian and Observer newspapers in the UK. Do you think it's a newsbeat that's in need of more generalists who come across it or more specialists who sort of adopt it as their choice?
I think that's what I find so fascinating about it. This is the fundamental kind of science of human civilization in many ways, right? How we feed ourselves, water, get the materials that we need to build our homes, and we rely on the life, right, and sustaining it. But it's seen as this kind of other subjects to the climate crisis. Once you kind of lose that blindness to life around you, you start to see landscapes very differently. For example, my family's from the west of Ireland on one side, and these peat bogs, burning turf, very traditional in the west of Ireland, in totally deforested landscapes that were once covered in rainforest. I never saw these areas like that. I thought they were kind of gorgeous, beautiful landscapes.
Yeah.
But once you start to have those realizations about areas that you love and that kind of feel as part of your soul and see that that applies to most of the planet, you realize how fundamental biodiversity is to everything. And so as you answer your question, yeah, I really think reporters and journalists and editors everywhere need to really just understand the basics on this subject.
I mean, we know that the biodiversity crisis is at least as important, at least as urgent, at least as threatening to people as the climate crisis around the world. But the media is often criticized for not giving the nature crisis as much coverage. Do you think that's fair criticism?
Yes, but I understand why. It's much more complicated in many ways because biodiversity quickly becomes everything, which is what's fascinating about the subject. But as a journalistic beat, you can find yourself talking about digital sequence information and how we transform genetic biodiversity into new drug discoveries and issues related to biopiracy in the developing world. then you, the next article you're writing is about deforestation and how systems might be developed to pay countries like Costa Rica and Brazil and to keep their forests standing. Then you're onto something completely different to do with bees or insects or whatever it might be. And there are fun stories in that too. And so with something so vast, maybe there's a misunderstanding of how newspapers and radio and TV work now, right? They present the news of the day. And so many environmental issues are huge, slow moving, and complicated.
Yeah.
And that is difficult to get to the top of the news agenda if you're a reporter pitching. And only when a big forest fire or there's a huge heat wave, as there is at the moment in Europe and China and North America, that's when it becomes an issue. However, I think that certain organizations are changing, and the climate crisis is really about how we live in balance with the planet, right, and the boundaries of Earth. And you can't have that conversation or think about those subjects as a newspaper, as a TV station, whatever it might be, without thinking about biodiversity and how we rely on all these systems.
Is there a risk when you're focusing on the biodiversity stories, because they're so diverse, because there's so much area to cover in so many different topics compared to climate, which tends to be relatively singular dimensional in some ways, is there a risk of it not being seen by people who are reading these stories or who are, as a holistic crisis, as a single crisis, but seeing each thing in its own silo?
That's definitely a risk, but to contrast with coverage of the climate crisis, there's clearly huge, huge reader interest in biodiversity loss and biodiversity itself. Nature is something that's fundamental that we all kind of feel and see in ourselves.
Is it?
But yeah, the siloed approach is something that I find really weird. Again, even at an international level, when you speak to the heads of desertification conventions, climate conventions, biodiversity conventions, it's kind of weird to separate it all.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, it's a weird way of looking at it in these three silos and trying to solve three problems, but really I think it's one.
A lot of the stories you're writing about are often based on very scientific or technical topics. How do you approach something with that level of complexity, especially when you're on a deadline and you might not be a specialist yourself on that?
So I'm lucky. I get to take my time with stories. And, well, I'm lucky again in that I can speak to experts who really study studies and they spend a lot of time helping me understand what their research shows and what it doesn't show. There was a time maybe a few years ago where quite dramatic warnings on the state of the planet and the health of the planet were widely read. But there was a report from Reuters, I think, after the pandemic and the war in Ukraine. People, readers, listeners, whoever it might be, are kind of sick of how negative a lot of media coverage seems.
Yeah.
And they want solutions, or at least a different kind of emotion than helplessness that many of us feel sometimes. And there, actually, some very technical and complicated issues can have a big impact. I was very struck by the reaction to an investigation we did in January on what avoided deforestation carbon credits, right? And so what we did there was we looked at what was behind a lot of the carbon neutral adverts that many major companies were using and telling us all about and telling us all we could fly and eat meat and do whatever we like, guilt-free in some cases. And we used quite complicated scientific research on avoided deforestation and counterfactual methods and the impact that many of these schemes actually were having, which were the basis of these credits. And we found that many were not what they seemed, and therefore that the adverts were highly, highly skeptical, right? And that was read by hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people, right? Over a million views on the article now. And I think there's a strong appetite actually for the technical, for the complicated, because readers know and appreciate that these subjects are, by definition, difficult sometimes, and they're prepared to learn and listen.
I mean, I suspect that there is a degree of that that can be attributed to the profile, I think, of a lot of The Guardian's audience and The Guardian's readership compared perhaps to some of the other mainstream global media outlets as well. I mean, would you perhaps think that there are differences from media house to media house in terms of how much appetite there is for a page one or a page two around solutions-based journalism?
Yeah, I'm not sure how I feel about solutions journalism, because I would include things that make you angry, I think, in that, right? With so many of these subjects, we know what we must do. We know how we need to change how we're living our lives. And it's often presented to all of us as if the kind of the world's ending. But this is an engineering challenge. This is a public policy challenge. This is a challenge to all of us on the way we live our lives. And that all needs to go in solutions, along with being angry and frustrated and whatever it might be with those who are getting in the way of that process, who are trying to confuse and disrupt that change that will have to happen regardless. It's just whether we do it in time or not.
So there's room for hope, there's room for excitement, there's room for passion, and there's room for hard-hitting and alarming facts.
Yes, and I don't think there's room for hopelessness.
Yeah. Let's turn for a moment to last year. I mean, you came to Montreal at the end of last year in 2022 to the big COP, the Conference of the Parties that the Convention on Biological Diversity was having, where they were talking about setting the targets, setting the goals for the next decade on nature. And out of that came this global biodiversity framework. How did you experience that meeting, and what did you think about its outcomes?
So it was a long time coming. So I was there in March 2020 in Rome at pre-negotiations, and I followed this process for 2 and a bit years, or whatever it would be. Virtually through the pandemic, I was in Geneva when they tried to restart negotiations. I was speaking with people all over the world. And so the first thing is, it was quite a big surprise to actually be there at COP15 to see it happening.
It actually took place.
It actually took place. I'm very impressed and quite moved always by the way COPs work. I am not somebody who has become cynical about them. I think seeing every single country negotiate all at the same table, where you see, I don't know, Palau right up there against China or Russia or whoever it might be, that's vital and important and frustrating process, right? Because it's done by consensus. But there are also areas that concern me, right? So there's targets to protect 30% of the planet and other targets on nature restoration, subsidies. It's vast. I worry that there'll be too much focus on protecting 30% of planet Earth when the main message, I think, on consumption, on how we should organize our economies, on what we should subsidize and what we shouldn't subsidize, those kind of things are actually going to be, I think, the most important.
The indirect drivers of biodiversity loss.
Yeah. Right, but that will be how we make this agreement a success or not. And that's the most important thing. As always, the most complicated. But it's going to be a battle to actually implement the final COP15 agreement, I think.
Well, I think from our side, we'll continue to do what we can to raise the science and the evidence out. And we really appreciate the work that you're doing from your side to get the message out to people so that they also understand the issues. And we look forward to doing this journey together with you for the next 10 years at least.
Thanks, Rob. See you soon.
I think back to working with students and also even speaking to my family and friends. You know, we'll see headlines and the question will be, how did they mess that up so badly? Did they have a fact checker? This is for science stories in particularly. Those are typically the ones I'm following and what people ask me about. And so many times I think it's actually not enough people work within that special skill set to be the bridge, but also time. There is a now requirement of news, and that can clash with how big some of these stories are. I think about IPBIS and the kind of intentionality and time given to the sort of work that IPBIS does, and I think there's really something to be said for that.
And it is. It's something that a lot of people comment on regularly about the IPBIS processes. They say, you know, you're doing an assessment and it's taking how long? 4.5 years? And then we do a fast track assessment and that only takes 2 years? And people are like, well, that's crazy. I mean, how could you possibly spend that long on one subject? And the answer is because the subject really deserves that level of concentration and of detail and of fact-checking. Patrick's ability to spend the time that he needs on a story, I'm sure, makes all the difference to the quality of his stories. But I'm not sure I agree with everything he said. You know, he talked about how most biodiversity or nature stories have what he called it a slow nature. I'm not so sure I agree with that. I think a lot of the biodiversity and nature stories that are really visceral at this point in our history are not happening slowly. They're happening rapidly, or almost too rapidly to keep up with in some cases. I'm not sure biodiversity issues are slow.
I would say biodiversity solutions are, though.
Yes.
There is an importance to demonstrating solutions. not for getting outraged, not for getting angered. These things are valid and fair responses and emotions. But, you know, those things are slow. The idea of how long it takes a policy to be implemented and how long it takes for there to be multinational agreements. So perhaps that's part of it.
Something that doesn't take any time is to give up. Give up hope, give up action, give up any kind of attention. And what I loved about this interview with Patrick is that his focus is so laser-like on not giving up hope, on the fact that there's no room for hopelessness when reporting on or acting on the biodiversity crisis.
I loved that. And I think that's so much a part of what we feel our options are. It sounds like, even though it can feel like too much, there is a desire for these kinds of complicated stories, these technical stories, which might be counterintuitive because we wonder, oh, people don't want to deal with that, or nobody wants those details. But I think humans are curious. Humans love learning. So it might be counterintuitive, but I think it makes sense.
I think if there was no appetite for technical or complicated stories, we would have very few listeners to the IPBIS podcast, Britt. It's about how we tell these stories. And I think it's the same for a journalist, right? It's finding ways of making the stories real and relevant and accessible to people and their daily lives, making it something that they care about and understand why they should care about.
Yeah, definitely. So it was amazing to hear these personal insights from Patrick, especially as he's one of the most influential media voices on the environment in print. But I'm curious, you know, how does that kind of coverage, how do these stories change if you look at one media outlet compared to another, particularly in different world regions?
It's incredibly important to ask that kind of question, Britt, and it's exactly why I connected with Sahana Ghosh, who is a journalist from Nature India, which is an online news site, and she's also worked for a number of other outlets in her home country. So, Sahana, you're from India, and you worked for many years with different scientists and journalists from all over the world. Have you noticed differences in writing on biodiversity and nature for audiences perhaps in the global south compared to those in the global north?
Yes, absolutely. And one of the more specific examples I can give you of the differences is the lack of data that journalists or scientists are grappling with in the global south, specifically in India. For example, you know, the kind of data sets that Europe has on its biodiversity, you know, going back in its environmental history, in terms of, say, the Himalayas, we are just starting to accumulate these long-term research data sets. Or take the example of the Sundarbans mangroves in India. Researchers have established a long-term monitoring series there in the mangroves. And these are just recent initiatives, whereas we've had these long-term data sets in Europe and elsewhere in the global north for longer periods of time. And I think that really comes off in our narratives.
I mean, I totally get the challenges of working in a data-poor versus a data-rich environment. As a science policy platform, it's something which we struggle with ourselves when we're trying to deal with some of the research in certain areas. What about the audience themselves? I mean, have you experienced a difference in levels of understanding or levels of awareness in Global South audiences versus Global North audiences?
Absolutely. I think the Global South audiences are aware, but they are aware of locally important flora and fauna. And this is where I feel journalism becomes important, because then we also need to branch out into regional languages. We need to really join hands with our peers in regional media houses to bring about those specific narratives.
You've worked for some of the local outlets of some very big global media houses. Do you target the work that you do primarily to your local audience? Do you keep the international audience in mind? How do you walk that balance between those two?
I think my personal philosophy is go global, in the sense that target the local audiences, but also remember that the local audiences also would want to know what is happening globally and if that story is somehow connected to what's also happening globally. If I were to take the example of invasive species, you know, invasive species is a very local story. But then you also realize as a reporter that this is a global problem. It's more about connecting the dots globally and locally and seeing, okay, this is a global problem. And how do we come together to address this global issue, which has manifestations locally?
So would you say that telling global stories for local audiences and perhaps local stories for global audiences has value?
Absolutely. I think it has a lot of value in connecting local audiences to global voices and global voices to local audiences, because also a lot of the research that we see in biodiversity is interdisciplinary or transdisciplinary, and there are a lot of international collaborations. I've written a lot about these collaborations, including one story on invasive species in the Himalayas, where this was about a research consortium, you know, spanning Europe and India, working together on documenting invasives for the long term. So I feel there's A, transdisciplinary research that's happening across the globe, B, the international collaborations that are happening in biodiversity, whether it's the negotiations or the research itself. And that's why I feel there's a lot of scope in going local.
I like the global. I think you hit the nail on the head when you talk about trying to find the elements of the story that are going to resonate to the community or the local community that may be perhaps particularly focused on one issue or the other. It gives the opportunity for us to tell a story to connect those concerns to some of the global drivers, the things that are really exacerbating the problem, creating some of the issues, and help show how the science, the global science, can also have very local implications, ramifications, and potentially solutions that can be offered as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And also whether a science which has been proven to do well in a particular region, can that be replicated in another region? And if it is replicated, what are the customizations in the way that the science is being done? I'm a big believer in collaboration, so maybe I'm sounding too optimistic, but yeah.
So on that exact note, the role of a journalist, particularly an online journalist, has really changed over time. Do you see yourself as an impartial reporter, or do you see yourself in some ways as an advocate and a campaigner as well? And how do you walk that sort of careful tightrope?
So I think when it comes to a story, I'm really detached. I mean, as much as I would, you know, really like vote for a particular species, wow, this is my favorite animal, you know, when it comes to reporting, I think it's just the facts and the data that I would tend to chase. And what happens is that we also have great sets of editors, whether it's in Mongabay or whether it's in Nature, who sort of help you get rid of the biases that you may have. And I think that really helps having great sets of editors.
I see so many parallels between the kinds of challenges and the opportunities that you have in the media and some of the work that we do in science policy as well, because one of the things we're always required to do is to present decision makers with the evidence, with the facts, with scenarios that they can then choose what actions they're going to take. And in some ways, I guess that's what you're doing in the media. You're presenting your audience with the facts of a story, the facts of a particular challenge to a particular species, but without connecting those dots for them and telling them what they should be doing about it.
Absolutely. And also, I think there's phenomenal amount of research that's being made available now to journalists. And if you just follow those updates, I feel that as a journalist, you're more informed and you can definitely balance your advocacy, you know, in your personal life versus the journalistic attitude that you need in your professional life. It tells me what is exactly happening. And maybe I had an idea for the last 5 years about certain things, which now actually has radically changed. So, for example, invasive species, you know, we always see narratives of invasive species being bad, but I was recently told by a bunch of researchers that not all invasive species, you know, need to be ostracized in the way that they are, because some of the things are not necessarily invasive. You really need to investigate whether they have actually become invasive or not. There's a difference between exotic and invasive species.
That's actually a spoiler for the IPBES assessment report that's going to be released later this year, which will look exactly at some of those issues around whether or not all introduced species become invasive, how many become invasive, and what that actually means. But I'm going to put you on the spot now. If you had to choose one of your environmental stories that you've worked on that had the greatest impact on you, what would that be?
One of the stories that I worked on was in central India a few years ago before the pandemic. It was about the sacred groves in central India. We have a lot of indigenous or tribal communities in central India. And when we looked at sacred groves and how they were being preserved, what became clear was that there was a role of conversion from one idea of belief system to, say, an organized religion, which was actually interfering with the protection of the sacred groves.
Hey.
So I think the idea in Global South is that there is a lot of intersection between cultural beliefs, religion, and science. So I think the stories that we have in Global South, they really need to mix the science with these kind of nuances. Otherwise, the narratives can be really skewed, one-dimensional. So I think that's one of my favorite stories, because I actually did not realize that this was the case in central India.
I'm not sure if you remember, but last year IPBES published an assessment report on the different values of nature. And in fact, sacred groves, exactly the story you're talking about, featured in that assessment as one of the illustrations of how different communities regard the values of nature, the plural values of nature, in different ways. If you had to leave one message, if you had to convey one message that you would want other journalists, especially perhaps younger, new journalists, to hear about reporting on environmental issues, what would that message be?
I would say that not all environmental issues are about climate change. You know, biodiversity is a key challenge in India, and look at biodiversity from all aspects. You know, it's a political story, it's a science story, it's an economics story. Biodiversity in itself demands a lot more attention. And just an advocate of science journalism, I would say, just read about the science, because it's fascinating to understand the science of biodiversity, and that makes your reporting more richer, more nuanced. So I feel just follow the science.
Sahana, thank you again for taking part in our podcast, and it's been a great pleasure.
Thanks, Rob. It's been a great pleasure at my end too, and keep up the good work.
That was a great interview, Rob, and super fascinating to hear how Sahana echoed Patrick's points about the importance of biodiversity not being overshadowed when we have these stories about climate change. And I love this idea of going global. I mean, we love a good portmanteau.
Whoa, we do indeed.
We love to see it. That makes so much sense to me, though, especially in the 21st century with the connectivity that we all have together, the kind of impacts our actions have. I think a lot of change happens locally, but we learn about it through global stories about local stories. I mean, it just is layer upon layer.
A very good example of this is the Invasive Alien Species Report.
Mm.
The concept of going global becomes so important because it allows a communicator or a journalist to tell a story about something that a person or a community will really identify with. So a local species or a local impact of a biological invasion, because that's something that resonates with people. But it also gives you the opportunity to then make that link, that big connection, to the global drivers of these problems and the things that are making them worse and are make them likely to get worse in the future as well. So going global is almost a mantra in some ways for taking science at a global level and making it relevant and making it interesting to people at a local level.
And speaking of mantra, I think that really this through line we got from both Sahana and Patrick is optimism. There are things to look forward to, and it doesn't have to be without the understanding of hard work, of necessary change, of nuance, of difficulty, but that there is no room for hopelessness.
It's a mantra to carry with us, I think, considering how much effort and time and work is going into addressing some of these problems. Britt, I have a question for you. When you are working with your students and when you're working in your communities, what kind of challenges do you face in connecting these resonances, these priorities to your students and to the people that you're working with when it comes to nature issues?
Yeah, I think the beauty of adolescence, also the obnoxiousness of adolescence, is the evolutionary brain wiring of selfishness, right?
Yeah.
And that's evolutionarily there. I mean, this has a purpose. We understand it. It's not unique. That's exactly what adolescent humans should do. They should be thinking about self and all of that exploration. I think because of that focus, honestly, global is sort of key to that kind of teenage experience. It's like, what am I doing? Oh, how's it impacting me? And then can we switch it? How did that impact the person next to you? Mm-hmm. How did that impact your friend group? How did that impact your classroom? You know, how did that impact your community? And I think that they are so good at the me part that they actually can be ready to switch it. So there's a kind of power in selfishness, in a way, in adolescent thinking.
Well, on the issue of younger people and younger people's approaches, I'm going to ask you to put a pin in that, Britt, because the last episode of our season is going to focus on youth issues and on the subject of things that we've talked about and are going to talk about. Sahana mentioned in her interview this issue of invasive alien species. I mentioned it a moment ago in the context of going global. It also happens to be the subject of our very next episode here on Nature Insight. So that's it for this episode of Nature Insight, Speed Dating with the Future. I'm Rob Spall.
And I'm Britt Garner. Join us in the next episode to hear about a complicated relationship people in South America have with a certain beaver, unwelcome ladybugs in the UK, and much more.
In the meantime, you can learn more about IPBIS's work on www.ipbis.net or on any of our social media channels. Just search for @IPBES, that's @IPBES. And if you've enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe to Nature Insight wherever you get your podcasts, to make sure you never miss your chance to speed date with the future. Thanks for listening. See you next week.